Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 144. My name is John. If you've had a dose of a freaky ghost, baby, you better call. I was 12 years old. I was at that age where pop culture influenced a lot of my life, even though it would still be decades before pop culture would meet up with my comic book obsession. I bought albums from bands that I saw on MTV. I was quite unsuccessfully trying to wear the fashion that the cool kids were wearing. Most of all, I was all about summer movies. Although some of the movies would have to get to Blockbuster or cable TV before I got to see them, I was excited for so many movies coming out. Spock proved that no one has to stay dead in science fiction. Alex defended the frontier from the Kodan Armada. And I was getting sent to my room for imitating the voice of Gizmo. The only other person in my family who really liked going to the movies was my mom, and even though I really wanted to see it, it was she who suggested that we go see Ghostbusters. We went to one of the biggest movie theaters in town, 6 screens. We went to McDonald's after the movie and talked about all the things that we loved about it. I couldn't tell you how many times I've watched that movie. Even with my aging memory, I could probably quote most of the lines. It's one of the few franchises where I've seen everyone in the theater. Hell, now that I think about it, the Burton Schumacher Batman films, the Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy, the Matrix trilogy, so far, and the Three Flavors Cornetto are the only ones that I can think of. No, not even the DCEU, because I watched Wonder Woman 84 and The Suicide Squad on HBO Max. I just saw Ghostbusters Afterlife, and since I'm looking for any excuse not to talk about politics for now, I've decided I want to talk about Ghostbusters. But not just Afterlife. All of them. I'm certainly going to spoil the hell out of them, even the 2016 reboot, so if you haven't seen all of them, you may want to wait on this podcast until you're all caught up. This is your only warning. I liked all the movies. Each one has good things going for it. If I had to rank the movies worst to first in likability, it would go Ghostbusters 2. For the rest of the podcast, I'm just going to call it 2. Ghostbusters 2016, hereafter known as Reboot. Ghostbusters Afterlife, which I'll just refer to as Afterlife, and Ghostbusters 1984. I'm going to call this one the original because I don't want to see how many times I can say Ghostbusters in a 30-minute podcast. By the way, I read that the 2009 video game is canon, but I don't play video games, so I didn't even know about its existence until I was reading about Evo Shandor. Also, I watched some, but not all, of the real Ghostbusters cartoon way back when it first came out, so I really can't say much about it. If you don't know the story about why it's called The Real Ghostbusters, there are some short videos on YouTube that I would recommend. However, I ran across Extreme Ghostbusters on Hulu a few months ago, and I watched it in its entirety before it dropped off the service. That was a surprisingly good show, even if it was aimed for kids. One episode in particular called Deadliners even creeped me out. Even though 2 is my least favorite, I'm going to start off with the one that is, ironically, the odd man out. Reboot. Reboot is separate because it takes place in a separate universe. Look, I've mentioned this before in relation to comic book movies. You can't go into a superhero movie expecting it to be exactly like the comic book. I mean, not even Watchmen was faithful. I grew up on the DC multiverse, where variations from one universe to another could be subtle or drastic. So when I go into a movie based on a DC comic, I go in thinking, this is an entirely new universe that I've never seen before. In the reboot universe, Venkman and company do not exist, and never did. This is a whole different set of people brought together by different circumstances. The all-female team? Never an issue for me. I just wanted a good, fun story. And that's exactly what they gave us. What I didn't like about it is very simple. I'm not a big fan of prolonged awkwardness, and I see a lot of that in McCarthy and Whig comedy movies. That's not to say I didn't like them, just not as much as Jones or McKinnon. Also, not a big fan of stupid, imbecilic characters. And that's all Chris Hemsworth was in Reboot. Of course, it's at this point where Gina insists that I mention that, well, at least he was very pretty. Oh, and I never need gratuitous celebrity cameos. Not even Ozzy Osbourne. In and of itself, Reboot is a great movie. It's fun, it has a lot of action, it has some good laughs. Is it as good as the original? Hell no! You're never going to capture that same magic that you did with the original. They couldn't even capture the same magic they did in 2, and that was with the same damn crew. It's like the 2015 San Antonio Spurs. Just because you bring back everyone from a championship doesn't mean you're going to have the same success. However, I will tell you there are 3 things that Reboot actually did better. First, it had the best villain of all 4 movies. Rowan was a sick little creep, and his surprise death halfway through the movie was just a ruse to allow him to become even more powerful. Plus, he actually does things himself instead of relying on minions. In the original and Afterlife, Gozer isn't even seen until the closing minutes of the movie. Viggo is in a fucking painting the entire movie, except for the last couple of minutes where he manages to get about 3 feet before the team repels him back. Second, Reboot has the best visuals of all the movies. Yes, I know. The original and 2 came out back in the 80s, when special effects were nowhere near as advanced as they are today. But the 80s movies, and even Afterlife, had a very limited palette over top of a drab setting. 80s New York looked pretty muted, and a little bit of pink and green didn't do much. There are some scenes in Afterlife that looked like they could have been filmed with a sepia filter, and no one would have known the difference. Reboot had much more vibrant settings, from the base above the restaurant to even the Aldridge Mansion. On top of all that, the ghosts were much more colorful and bright, so it was more visually appealing. And lastly, Reboot did something the other movies didn't. They advanced the weaponry. The shredder, the bombs, and most of all the handguns were inspired additions. Reboot is a very admiring homage to the original that flips some ideas around and comes at the concept from a slightly different direction. Most of the original cast makes appearances, even an image of Harold Ramis. But here's the thing. They're all different characters from the original. This, if anything, should reinforce the idea this is an alternate universe, but also, it's been given the blessing of the original, and that alone should have brought it more respect. Leslie Jones was great in Reboot, especially when she is literally slapping a ghost out of Melissa McCarthy. Her scenes at the concert with the mannequins and the ghost on her shoulder were standout moments. However, Kate McKinnon thoroughly steals the show with her crazy portrayal as Holtzman. From her line about finding uses for a cadaver to licking her gun before going after the ghosts, she was fucking amazing. Not long after the movie came out, I was texting about the movie with a woman I was seeing. She said Holtzman was so hot, it made her want to be a lesbian. Which is fine, because she was already bisexual to begin with. Anyway, my point about Reboot is the people who dislike it are the ones expecting it to be just like the original. If you set aside the preconceived notions and take it for what it is, you'll realize it really is a fun, standalone movie. The other three obviously go together, since they are all one continuous story. What can I say about the original that hasn't already been said? This was a movie ahead of its time. Can you imagine what they could have done with our CGI tech today? You could tell how much heart Aykroyd and Ramis put into the writing because they were perfect as their characters. Bill Murray was, well, Bill Murray, sardonic as ever. All the secondary characters have their moments, and unfortunately, that includes Ernie Hudson as the fourth member of the team whose role got cut back. But I think his character is finally going to get his due. Annie Potts is great as the crabby Janine, and you just gotta love Rick Moranis as the socially awkward accountant Lewis, pining over Sigourney Weaver's Dana. Three paranormal scientists. Is that an oxymoron? Anyway, three paranormal scientists are kicked out of their university jobs and decide to go into business for themselves as professional ghost catchers. They basically stumble their way through the process, often causing more property damage than the ghosts they capture. But they also discover the influx of ghosts is part of a deeper problem they have to solve, despite the constant interference from government. Okay, quick political rant. Ghostbusters is often cited as a libertarian movie because Venkman and company break away from the public sector, where results are not a priority, to a new business with new technology that only they know how to build and operate. As bizarre and scary as their blasters and traps are, they still do the job. You may freak out at the proton stream, but it's better than dealing with the devil dog trying to possess your body. It's the pompous bureaucrat Walter Peck, played perfectly by William Atherton, who triggers a near cataclysm by shutting down the power to the containment unit. Government doesn't know how to run private business the way the business owners do. When government interferes, bad things happen. Get the fuck out of the way and let the people who know what they're doing provide the service, even if you think it's dangerous. Read about the Schechter brothers, who owned a Jewish deli in New York, and you'll begin to understand what I'm trying to say. Okay, rant over. The original Ghostbusters is one of the all-time great science fiction comedies and an iconic 80s movie. If you haven't seen it, well, there really is no hope for you. And I really don't know why you're listening to this podcast. If you have seen it, you get how great it is and don't need me gushing over things you already know. The sequel? Not so much. I'm not a big fan of the Janine-Lewis relationship in the movie. Her flirtation with Egon was a nice side story in the original, and it would have been nice to see that continue. Viggo is easily the worst of the bad guys. A talking painting and pink slime just don't scream villainy. And if you insist on doing a gratuitous celebrity cameo, Don't do it like each Marine did, staring slack-jawed, turning around to make a comment, and then go back to staring slack-jawed. You're an actor. Do some other expression. I get the feeling they didn't think the audience would be emotionally invested in some random baby possessed by a medieval sorcerer. So they made it Dana's baby. And then they realized Daddy Venkman would have been a horrible idea for the franchise at that point. So they had to shoehorn in Dana's breakup, marriage, childbirth, and divorce. And the painting of the team surrounding the baby at the end is truly an eye-rolling moment. Other than that, it is good. Everyone is still funny. It has some great one-liners. And in the hands of lesser writers and comedians, those scenes with the dancing toaster or the Statue of Liberty would have earned the movie a Razzie. I really like Peter McNichol as the oddball art restorer turned into a minion of Vigo, and it's worth seeing, even though it's mostly forgotten in the direct sequel that finally came out 32 years later. Not many people were excited about another Ghostbusters movie. The reboot was considered a flop. The new movie was to be set in Oklahoma, which is a far cry from New York City. Early images and posters showing the Ecto-1 in a field of tall grass didn't impress a lot of people. I was ready for it, though. I went back to my default setting. This is a new story, and you never know. They might just pull it off. You could tell this was going to honor the original from the trilling piano keys before the screen even lights up to go through the production cards. I thought I saw Muncher's face in the clouds behind the Columbia lady, but I checked it online and I think that's just how the clouds always look. The movie opens with a man on the run from a ghost. It didn't take long for me to realize that keeping the man in the shadows and concealing his face meant this must be Egon. And they can't show him because Harold Ramis has passed away. He makes his way to the front porch of a farmhouse and holds up a ghost trap, seemingly taunting whatever is coming his way. He's trying to lure his pursuer into a larger trap under the ground in front of the house, which begins to work, but loses power. Knowing he's failed, he runs inside, hides that trap that he had used as bait, and sits in a chair preparing for the inevitable. We see a heavy fog roll into the room and for a moment takes on the appearance of the devil dogs from the original. Ghosts attack him and the scene fades to black. This is a great, albeit melancholy, beginning. Even if you don't catch on that it's Egon, you can feel the tension. You think the trap's going to succeed because, hey, this is a Ghostbuster movie. It's an on-screen death for a beloved character originally played by a respected writer and actor who passed away years ago. Strong start. In New York, a woman, Callie, and her two children, Trevor and Phoebe, are evicted from their apartment for not paying their rent, despite her pleas to the landlord to give them just a little more time since she just inherited property from her estranged father in Oklahoma. She originally intended to go get what she could from the property and come back, but much to the chagrin of her children, it becomes their new home. Since the place is dilapidated and worthless in the middle of nowhere, Callie feels their lives have hit rock bottom. Anyone who's paid attention to talk about the film in the months before its release, or savvy enough to deduce who the man is in the opening scenes, knows that Callie is Egon's daughter. This is not the first time a franchise has tried to extend itself by having a character's progeny take over, but this one will manage to pull it off. Callie wallows in self-pity while the children try to make their way in the small town near the farm. Fortunately, Trevor has some mechanical skills and Phoebe has the same scientific acumen as her grandfather, as well as his social awkwardness. Trevor takes a job at a burger joint and begins a budding relationship with a coworker named Lucky. Phoebe voluntarily takes summer school and uncharacteristically makes a new friend interested in the paranormal who calls himself Podcast. They also find out the teacher, Gary, is interested in the unusual and unexplainable seismic activity nearby. Trevor and his co-workers go to a nearby mountain and have a paranormal experience, while Phoebe, with the help of Egon's invisible ghost, finds the trapped ghost that Egon hid just prior to his death, which she, Podcast, and Gary unknowingly set free, and it heads up to the mountain. Egon's ghost also leads Phoebe to his secret lab with all the gear from the original crew, which Phoebe fixes. Meanwhile, Trevor finds a broken-down Ecto-1 and repairs it. This must be a Hollywood thing, but I don't understand how Carrie Coon, who plays Callie, got top billing for this film. Her character stayed in the background for most of the movie, while the children really carried the story. Both go through the new kid in town trope in their own way and become instantly relatable. So the sequel is maintaining good footing as it goes through its story. While testing the repaired proton pack, Phoebe and Podcast run into a metal-eating ghost they come to call Muncher. Meeting up with Trevor, test-driving the Ecto-1, they pursue and capture Muncher, but not until they've caused considerable damage to various buildings in the town, including the burger joint. The police arrest them, and Phoebe uses her one phone call to call the number from the Ghostbusters commercial the original team made. Race Dance answers, and Phoebe learns that after business dried up for the original team, Egon believed Gozer was still a threat. When the rest of the team didn't believe him, Egon stole all their gear and moved to Oklahoma, because that is where the metal for the building on Central Park West came from, designed by Ivo Shandor, as mentioned in the original, who owned the mines and built the town of Somerville, Oklahoma. Trevor, Lucky, Phoebe, and Podcast find Shandor entombed inside a temple hidden in a mine in the mountain. They also see proton beams Egon had rigged to go off any time Gozer attempts to escape from the temple. It's here where this movie, three decades apart from the previous, performed a feat rarely seen in sequels that try to introduce an entirely different cast. They successfully pass the torch, and they do it in a way that should never have worked. They take the story away from the largest city in the United States with its millions of people and boundless opportunities for strange characters and put it out in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma, to focus on the mine where they got the ore to make the unusual metal for the building in the original movie. Are you fucking kidding me? Now, please don't misunderstand. That's fucking brilliant and inspired. But how the hell did they get the studio to agree to it? To me, this movie's setting is important because everyone else is looking out for New York. Who else but Egon was looking out for Somerville, Oklahoma? Gary is at Walmart when he finds miniature versions of the giant Stay Puft Man from the original movie climbing out of their marshmallow packages, swarming all over the store. He turns a corner and sees a devil dog exactly like the ones from the original movie. Like the original, the devil dogs, Vince Clortho and Zool, seek out hosts. This time, it's Gary and Callie, respectively. The possessed Gary then destroys Egon's proton streams guarding the temple to allow escape. Just like Lewis and Dana, they copulate and later transform into devil dogs in order to bring Gozer into our dimension. The entombed Shandor awakens, expecting to rule with Gozer, but she immediately rips him in half. Ghosts fly out of the mountain and wreak havoc on Somerville. Having put the pieces together of what is happening, including the giant trap at the farmhouse, Trevor, Phoebe, and Podcast arrive at the temple and manage to trap Zool, freeing Callie and causing Gozer to weaken. Then they speed away from the temple back to the farmhouse. From the music, to the similarities in characters, to Easter eggs such as the tall stack of books in Egon's farmhouse, Afterlife borrows heavily from the original movie. Normally, I would be a big detractor of a sequel using the same events and story beats as its predecessor. I mean, look at The Hangover or the Avengers movies. This made perfect sense for this movie. We all thought Gozer was gone after the original. No, that was just its latest attempt. The past is repeated because none of the new characters are aware of what the originals went through. The only thing that I questioned was, why Gary and Callie? Lewis and Dana lived in the building where Gozer was meant to enter our dimension in the first movie. You may even say they were unknowingly living in Gozer's New York temple. No one lived at the temple in Somerville, so the dogs sought out hosts. Why those two? Did they or Gozer know Callie was related to Egon? Did they go after Gary just because he liked Callie, similar to how Lewis had a crush on Dana? And if that's the case, why did Zool later possess Lucky? On the plus side, I do like the simple plan to distract Gozer with jokes while sneaking a trap under Zool. So much smarter than any kind of direct assault. Also, J.K. Simmons as Evo Shandor is proof that that guy is a good fit in any franchise. Phoebe, like Egon, uses the trap Zool to lure Gozer to the front of the farmhouse where the giant trap is set. Just as before, they trigger the trap, but the generators fail. Zool is freed, and this time takes over Lucky, restoring Gozer to full strength. All seems to be lost. Until three proton streams strike Gozer. Winston, Ray, and Peter have arrived and immediately cross the streams as they did years before. But Gozer is stronger and rips the streams apart and knocks the trio to the ground. Phoebe fires her proton gun at Gozer and Egon's ghost materializes next to her. The originals get back up and fire their proton guns as well. Trevor uses another proton pack to charge the generators, and finally they spring the trap, capturing Gozer and its minions. Final words and heartfelt goodbyes are given by everyone to Egon. His spirit ascends after a long hug from Callie. The original team heads back to New York. Venkman spends time with Dana while Winston and Janine talk about the future of the Ghostbusters. Back in the original headquarters, on the old containment unit, a red warning light blinks. Now that is how you successfully pass the torch from one team to the next. I'm not talking about reboots like Ghostbusters 2016 or the various incarnations of Batman or Spider-Man. I can count on one hand the other franchises that have done it as well using direct sequels. The Rocky franchise, moving on to Creed, is the only one I can think of that seems to have truly succeeded so far. Star Trek was screwy because they had Next Generation from TV, which in and of itself was passing the torch, and it took them a couple of seasons to become consistently good. Then they moved them up to take over the movie franchise, and Generations was all kinds of messed up before the great First Contact, and then stumbling again till it ended. Then you have the alternate timeline from J.J. Abrams, which is kind of part sequel, but also kind of alternate universe. And that had its own problems, but still gave us three really good movies. Similarly, X-Men started off well with First Class and Days of Future Past before two really bad flops. Ghostbusters did it by going in a direction no one expected. Now, I don't care what anybody else says. I think the 2016 reboot is good. I think they checked all the boxes necessary for that kind of standalone alternate universe movie. I ranked it below Afterlife, but it was whisper close. Afterlife gets the nod really just because it is a true sequel. And don't give me this bullshit about, we no longer create new ideas, we're just using the same characters over and over. How many adventures did Sherlock Holmes have before his creator killed him off and brought him back to life because of the backlash? Do you think the British were all, oh, why do we have to read another Sherlock story? Why can't you make it a new character? How about this? Why don't you complain about all the Greek myths constantly going back to those tired old Olympian god characters, or the Romans who took those same characters and turned them into alternate versions? Enough. Just accept the fact that for as long as mankind has told stories, the popular characters get brought back again and again. And I hope that will include the new generation of Ghostbusters. The tip of the hat to Jason Reitman and the gang. You did Harold proud. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.